So as we continue about this, sorry about that little glitch with the computer there and that pause, we're back to talking about what constitutes training in terms of the work we do in clinical supervision. So we're teaching supervisees how to conceptualize clients according to various theoretical frameworks and to individualize treatment goals. We're also helping them, again, not to make these generalities about clients, but to really look on a number of different personal client variables, looking at things like what is the history that led this client to this given time, what is the age or developmental level of a client, what are cultural issues for that client, a client's maturity, and even things like a client's level of willingness to approach or learn certain skills. Because we know that just because a client's showing up for therapy doesn't necessarily mean they're really at a level of certain readiness to actually approach or change certain issues. Then we're also looking at, when we're training a supervisee, how their knowledge base and their ability to approach client dilemmas is, problem solving, crisis management, and teaching them different roles and expectations in the given setting you're in. I'm always surprised when we look at how oftentimes in graduate programs, there's not a lot of training about the, quote, business aspect of mental health in a practicum or internship setting. So, for example, you know, there's different dynamics, say, with working in a community mental health sort of setting, having to meet productivity standards, what that entails, versus maybe like a private practice or an agency, a for-profit versus a non-profit, the type of setting we're working in or the clientele we're working with. And those are important skills to work with a supervisee on. So there's three main things I talk about: the development, the process variables, and the case conceptualization. So first of all, in terms of training, we're helping a supervisee to develop an individual professional identity. Then we're helping him or her by helping them learn to consistently offer emotional support and high levels of Rogers process variables. Now, in case you don't remember what that means, one of the things that Carl Rogers had studied years ago in the 60s and 70s was the whole degree of what made counseling even effective. What's different about what we do as clinical counselors or therapists versus someone just talking to a friend or family member? And they found out that there's process variables that even in spite of the degree to which we employ certain theoretical techniques that are really important. So things like empathy, things like being able to get in a client's world and really, really hear and experience with him or her what they're going through, as if they're able to say, yeah, you got it, you understand me. Things like sincerity. Clients can tell when we're being real, when we're being true to ourselves, when we're really relating from a point that's sincerely us. They can tell when we're genuine. It's one thing, you know, when someone's just doing a job versus another thing where it really feels like we want to make an impact. We want to genuinely hear the narrative that the client's bringing to us about his or her presenting concern, and we want to make a difference. Things like unconditional positive regard. Many of our clients, I can't tell you how many times I've heard this, will say things like, gosh, I've never experienced someone genuinely listening to me. I've never experienced what it's like to be heard without shame or judgment or just to be met where I'm at. So what we do is very valuable, this offering of emotional support and having high degrees of process variables. In fact, more recent literature has showed that even if someone had PhD level training in given theories, that they weren't necessarily perceived as more competent by a client if they also didn't have high levels of process variables and emotional support. So it goes to show that someone with a basic level of training on the theoretical issues, but who has high levels of this emotional support and process variables, is perceived as more competent by clients. So we really cannot minimize that. And then another part of the training we do with supervisees is assisting the supervisee in awareness of various types of clients that maybe push their buttons. It is so important, whether we're just starting out in an internship phase or early level of our training and development, or if we're even independently licensed, to make sure we have that collegial contact. One, that's important for building a number of people we can consult with in terms of what would be a reasonable scope of practice for just making sure we're ethical. But also just to learn to bounce things off people and to have that other background. So let's look at each of these in terms of, you know, a little bit greater depth about what I just said training entails. So when we're talking about supporting the professional development of a supervisee, we're talking about the work of therapy, but the many associated tasks. We're talking about diagnosis and treatment of disorders according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders. I've been surprised how many people, even in their graduate programs, weren't familiar with this. They really hadn't known, like, what are the codes, what are the numbers, what are the criteria, differential diagnosis. So these are key things we want to make sure that we understand. For example, what is the difference between dysthymia versus major depression? What are the difference in time frames between certain types of disorders and others? And how to look at things in terms of clusters of symptoms and not just one or two isolated symptoms. So we're talking about helping a supervisee do a thorough psychosocial assessment. We're also talking about ongoing conceptualization and treatment planning. So looking at not just vague treatment goals like, quote, feeling less depressed or being more confident, but really specific treatment goals. Looking at development of concrete behavioral goals. How will we know when we've reached a point in therapy that life's different, that the person feels less depressed? What will be going on? So we're also wanting to make sure what we're doing is evidence-based. This is something where the supervisee may have some sense of this, but they also may need to know more and broaden their awareness of what evidence-based practices are for certain types of issues for clients. And we're making sure that there's an appropriate level of informed consent, that the client really knows who they are in terms of their training and licensure process, who a supervisor is, and what's going on. What I tend to do is I have each of the clinicians at my practice have a little bio that would say something about who they are, perhaps if they're in a training process at a school, towards their master's or postgraduate work, how many hours they have, what supervision entails, just general stuff, or what type of population they have worked with or are working with, just so kind of like who your counselor is. So I have people put that in with the initial paperwork so the clients have a real sense of that off the bat. I firmly believe in the importance of, when we're sharing information with clients and getting informed consent, saying things a variety of ways. So not just verbally, because sometimes our clients will forget or hear things a certain way they want to hear it, but to say it verbally, but then also to have things in writing or have different ways that we re-highlight that. So in terms of professional development, we're helping supervisees build awareness of symptomology for various DSM disorders. We're helping them do the differential diagnosis, facilitating discussion of even the implications of giving certain disorders. I know I've had a number of clients, especially when I have to fill out papers for disability types of stuff or work leave, family medical stuff, where clients tend to think, if my employer or if this other person out there knew that I was depressed or anxious or had a mental health issue, they'd be more understanding. But the fact is, we cannot promise that to someone. When information is released out there, we don't know what other parties will do, whether they be people determining disability, whether they be employers or schools, courts, or someone in the community. So one of the things that we really have to teach supervisees in terms of their professional development is that it's possible for us to, in that consent process and the release of consent signing, to determine which parts will be released and to make sure we document a clear understanding of the pros and cons potentially of releasing that information. Then the other thing we want to work with the supervisee on is how to develop a model for treating diagnosed conditions with appropriate standards of care. So part of that is, beyond their schooling, how do they connect with other professionals? How do they determine and build a scope of practice where they have enough others are checking in with about what they would do in a similar setting with a similar population? Then, finally, we want to help them develop skills about how to modify, as needed, treatment planning and approach. Now, record keeping is very important. A lot of times we tend to focus on the actual sessions and what happens during them, the treatment planning, but we need to really highlight off the bat with the supervisee the importance and basically the essential mandatory role of documentation and record keeping. This is not just about helping us recall what happened overall in the narrative from treatment planning and first session throughout the sessions, but this really also is about documenting medical necessity, documenting that we're doing evidence-based practices, but it also helps look at when we need to consult with collateral sources. And we really need to paint a picture to a supervisee that we're just not trying to inconvenience them with the administrative tasks involving record keeping and agency policy, but this is really about ethics. This is about ethically documenting that what we do is necessary. And this is not just an inconvenience, but this is something that laws, regulations, and institutional policies require. This is something that we really need to highlight that we will be going over. I've seen through the years sometimes people slack in this area where maybe through the course of supervision they've spent less focus on the documentation and record keeping. But I think that's really important for us to highlight, because the fact is, if there is a debate over if something is ethical or not, if someone makes an allegation, oftentimes the board's going to involve what are the notes, what is documented, who has the supervisee met with, what were their licenses, what did they recommend. We're also looking at, in terms of training supervisees, evaluation. Evaluation, of course, is a core component. And we'll talk in a bit about how, of course, that can lead to anxiety on the part of the supervisee. But evaluation isn't just towards licensure. There could be evaluation on a number of levels. First of all, this supervisee may be hired by the agency we work at. So there's the hiring and firing aspect of things. Are they performing, quote, up to par? Are they doing what is expected by the agency that we're working for. There additionally may be some requirements of a school. Let's say this person's in a practicum or internship or taking classes at a college level. There's some type of evaluation they're going to be receiving for their courses. There also may be a evaluation to the counselor, social worker, and marriage and family therapist board. And one of the things we frequently forget that I think is really important is allowing for evaluation not just of the supervisee, but even of the supervisor, the setting, the agency, and the process. I think that's very important because we don't want to paint a picture just of the supervisor imposing some level of evaluation on the supervisee, but I think one of the things that can increase the comfort level and help facilitate a more meaningful supervision experience is making sure off the bat that the supervisee realizes that he or she can share feedback, that it's welcome. And I think we need to also let our supervisees know how to do that. It's one thing saying, oh, we want your feedback, we want your input, but it's a whole other way of maybe role modeling how to do that. And we will talk in a bit in more detail about that, about even maybe providing to a supervisee some types of lead-ins for questions, for things that they may want to know about, what that looks like. So there's several ways we evaluate what a supervisee does. And each has its own pros and cons. So that's where it's important for us when we're trying to have super/vision to really conceptualize the case on the level of the supervisee and the client, or us with the supervisee, of making sure we match the type of evaluation with what might be most beneficial in a given situation. So much of the time, we've tended to rely historically on things like self-report. You know, a supervisee telling us about what happens in their case. Oh, when I met with so-and-so, this happened, that happened. But keep in mind when we do that, that means we're trusting that what the supervisee says is accurate. We're trusting that they're sharing the fullness of the perception. And there may be some bias towards the things that the supervisee focuses on, that they choose to focus on, because they may have areas that are more of a challenge for them. But I always tend to pay attention to what is it also that the supervisee's not saying, what parts are being left out. So the problem with self-report is that it tends to only be as good as what is reported. So sometimes it's useful. I've seen some agencies almost have like a form in terms of how to have a pretty comprehensive way of looking at a case. So that's helped some supervisees, but just some general considerations of, okay, how do I kind of look overall at this case? What would that look like? Another way we can evaluate, which we just made reference to a little bit ago, is using process or case notes. Again, this is something that many times is accepted, but the key is how would a supervisee know what to write or how to write a note? I've realized through the years of doing some supervision with people that oftentimes supervisees have not been taught how to write a decent note. I've had times where I've had to sit down with a number of supervisees because their notes almost have been like a narrative story. Something like, I met with so-and-so client, we did this, they said this, then I said this. As opposed to more of a record about what is clinically appropriate and how it meets that standard. So I've had to teach on a number of situations my supervisees things about what I call buzzwords. Things like explored with the client A, B, and C. Processed such and such with the client taught such and such skills, role modeled such and such in session, provided education about da-da-da, empathized with da-da-da. So again, how they want to use those action words and words that substantiate that we're using evidence-based treatment. So sometimes the process notes may be challenging for earlier developmental level supervisees. So we really want to provide some guidance about that. Now, as we consider other methods of evaluation, there's things like audio and videotapes or times that we could sit in on sessions. The tricky thing about that, obviously, it may be hard for us to get the totally genuine reaction of either the supervisee or the clients. I mean, if someone knows they're being taped, they may focus on certain aspects of the clinical relationship more or less than others. They may be a little bit different than they would normally be in that situation. But in theory, the audio or videotape can give us a more quote-unquote real reaction in terms of what's really happening with that supervisee and client dynamics. So the other thing we can do is we can sit in on sessions. Sometimes that's helpful because the supervisees, especially at earlier stages of development, may be coming to us asking for us to be more of a teacher anyway. They might be saying, gosh, I feel stuck. I'm not sure how to deal with this. Can you show me how to deal with such and such issue? So it might be helpful for us to sometimes, if you are a clinical supervisor, to sit in on a session and be able to intervene. In addition, it also can be helpful if we're there to be able to reinforce later in clinical supervision that there are things that sometimes supervisees are doing well that they don't realize they're doing well. I remember with a past supervisee, she mentioned a certain client that she felt she was just stuck with. And she's like, can you come in and sit and maybe help me on that session with this client? And when I sat in, not knowing in great detail all she had done with the person, later she's like, wow, you pretty much said the same thing I said before, but it seemed like just having a second person saying it, or maybe using a little bit different words, seemed to help her really hear that. And so sometimes it can be beneficial that way for the client and for the supervisee to realize, like, I'm not as off as I thought I was. It's not just that I did the wrong thing, but maybe that it's the client struggling to hear it. Or is that a stage of change where they're not ready yet for really implementing change? Videotapes, again, of another level of evaluation, because you're able to see the nonverbals. You're able to pause it, just like with the audio tape, and to look, oh, what was happening here? I noticed this. Obviously, there's another level of intrusiveness, though, with the videotape. So sometimes a live observation might be a better way to go. There can be things like group supervision as well. And I think that it's good to have group supervision as a supplement or an add-on to individual supervision, because with group supervision, you have the dynamic of a number of supervisees at various levels of development. So they're able to help each other through their dynamic in a way that is a little bit different from what we do in a one-on-one supervisor-supervisee session. Group supervision is also cost-effective. It's more comprehensive, and it increases the conceptualization of issues, because as someone verbalizes in the group their concerns, there may be a multitude of ways that other supervisees approach the issue. It can help build empathy. The sense, just like a therapy group would, that we're not alone in this. No matter whether we're at an earlier stage of development or no matter whether we've done this for years, there's a sense of, You know, we all have some level of struggles. Also, knowing that you have a team of people kind of conceptualizing things together and bouncing ideas and suggestions off of each other can help ease some of that burden. It also particularly can be helpful in terms of discussions of ethical and professional issues. One of the things I talk a lot about in my ethics seminar is the idea that we don't want to wait until there seems to be an increased likelihood of an ethical concern. But we want to proactively be able to demonstrate, to document, to have noted that we've already been talking with similarly licensed professionals in a similar setting about what they would do about a client such as ours. Group supervision helps us explore a variety of our feelings, attitudes, and behaviors. And what's neat about group supervision is that ability to model things. While we can obviously do role plays with a supervisee in the one-on-one supervision, there's some dynamics where the modeling and the role playing of various types of techniques can occur at another level, which can be really interesting. Also, we can talk about stress management, burnout reduction, and just general therapeutic self-care. Keep in mind, group supervision should be a supplement to individual supervision. I have had some people that told me that at one of the agencies around town, they only did group supervision. So the idea is not supposed to be that there's only group supervision, but that there's some individual and group. Because again, with each person being at a different level of development, we really need to have that individual supervision to tailor to what that person needs. And finally, even just role-playing can be a useful way of evaluating, both in terms of skill building and skill training, affirming things, but it also helps us to directly observe how skills are done. I know the supervisee may have a tendency to feel like they're on the spot, but it can help us to really accurately engage how much a supervisee has a level of a given skill. Now, there's a question out there that I think is a pretty important consideration. When we talk about supervision, at least in today's seminar, we're going to be highlighting clinical supervision, the training supervision, so to speak, as I've begun to talk about. So development of clinical skills, client welfare, assessment and intervention skills, the diagnosis and treatment of mental health disorders, essentially. But we find out, depending on the agency or where we're working or the setting, sometimes the clinical supervisor is also what they call an administrative supervisor. Sometimes this person is also looking at agency policies and goals, procedures, how things are documented, how to increase efficiency or output of what's done. And this can make a difference to a supervisee. I guess I wonder, if you were to think about it, do you think a supervisee would want the clinical supervisor to also be doing the administrative tasks, or possibly to have someone differently focusing on those who wasn't also the clinical supervisor? Well, the literature suggests that supervisees want to make sure that they get their time for clinical supervision. If they have case challenges, if they have concerns, if they need direction, especially at the earlier stages of development, they don't want that to be shortchanged by the administrative stuff. I remember, especially at community-based agencies, when there were just so many clients we had to deal with, unfortunately, a lot of the time when we'd have weekly staff meetings, it was just basically doing damage control, trying to do updates, trying to juggle papers and see who could get into the doctor quickest, how we would assign that, what we would do. to where I think the thing that a lot of the less experienced supervisees felt burdened about was that they really didn't get guidance on their cases. So I find when there are meetings for supervision, whether they're individual or group, sometimes it's good at the beginning of the meeting to really talk about what the breakdown of the time is going to look like so that the supervisees don't feel like the burden is over-focused on the administrative aspects of things. So supervision, I want to highlight this. Supervision needs to be a career-long endeavor. What I mean by that is, even if you're someone who's been doing this for decades, even if you are independently licensed, even if you've heard a lot of the same stuff at seminar after seminar, even if the clients tend to sort of blur together and many of the clients seem to repeat themselves almost, keep in mind that it's important, no matter how seasoned you are, to have a community of colleagues, mainly for ethics, but also in terms of keeping in check. We can't possibly, even if we are independently licensed, really accurately self-evaluate everything. So supervision isn't just for the starting out clinician who is working towards licensure, but for someone even who's been in the system as a clinician for years. So the types of roles that we do in supervision are many. Self-efficacy is one of the things, just building that sense of, I can do this. Validation. Sometimes it's hard to really validate when we're in companies or organizations where people are so busy and so productivity focused that we don't always really see each other to be able to have a discussion. In fact, the agencies I've been at, one of the things I think that I've had to highlight with people is make sure that you're an advocate for yourself, that you're productively going, you know, proactively, I mean, going out there and seeking out contacts with colleagues. Because sometimes the agencies will not necessarily facilitate that. And it's important to have that. Another role in supervision is affirmation. What's going well? I think since there is such an evaluative component to supervision, we forget that affirmation and validation are also important. But in addition to that, we're looking at exploration. We're looking at broadening competency. Looking at what areas does a clinician feel he or she is competent at already, and what areas does there need to be some growth? Supervision hopefully would also be a safe space where there could be some level of experimentation in terms of trying out different techniques. I mean in the supervision context. I'm not talking about with a client where that might be unethical. But in a supervision context, you could say, oh, how might this situation work if you use solution-focused approach versus CBT? What might it look like if we tried this versus that? What are the pros and cons? And that's something you could discuss with your supervisor. And supervising also is hierarchical. There is a relationship with a power differential there. So there does need to be boundaries. Supervision has several key elements. It should be proactive. There should be a planned schedule of how often, how frequently supervisees and supervisors meet. In addition, there should be an understanding of when there are needs or things that need to be discussed even beyond the planned time, what is the procedure for that? So proactive, planned, supervision should also be purposeful. It should be goal-oriented and intentional. So why even have supervision? What are some of the desired outcomes? Some of them include mastery of certain skills, but also enlarging one's understanding of clients, those conceptualization skills that we've referred to. enlarging one's area of process issues, increasing awareness of self and the impact on the process, overcoming personal and intellectual obstacles toward learning and mastery, deepening one's understanding of the concepts and theory that apply to a case, providing a stimulus to research, or maintaining the standards of service. Now, recent literature has highlighted that there are what they call three supervisory styles, those being attractive, interpersonally sensitive, and task-oriented. Again, we're not saying one's right or another's wrong, but just different styles. So the attractive supervisory style is more one that really places a strong emphasis on development of those Rogers process variables: friendliness, empathy, support, and warmth. I could say, for example, my first experience being a supervisee in my internship 1 and 2 in Cincinnati was the style of supervision. I was in my young 20s. The supervisor was in his 70s. He had a great deal of experience and was a kind, caring gentleman, was very supportive, had high levels of the process variables, but struggled, or maybe wasn't so comfortable in more of the teaching aspect of things, and would encourage me to go to the staff meetings and bring up cases and things there. So his level was more of the attractive style of supervision. The second style of supervision is called interpersonally sensitive supervision. So this is more a intuitive supervision, go with the flow. It's more of a creative process or resource building. And that last one is task-oriented, which is structured, didactic, or teaching, and evaluative. These aren't necessarily just neat, exclusive categories and compartments. Hopefully what we're doing and what we want to highlight today is we're matching where a supervisee's at and really looking at what is the vision for the interaction, the supervisory interaction. What does that look like? What does this particular supervising need? Are there areas that maybe they do need a more structured and didactic approach, but other areas where they need more of empathy and process variables? So I think it's very vitally important that in addition to any mandatory procedures or documentation for supervision, any contracts of things like with a counseling board or with the school, that for our agency or for the particular dynamics between a supervisor and supervisee, that we really have a sound initial supervision agreement. I found that to be extremely helpful. So with that, there's several elements that I include. So some of that would be the board requirements. There may be some sort of company contract, so to speak, about what the requirements are about the agency or the setting that the supervision will take place in. Even things like the goals of the supervision arrangement. Is it that there's certain number of hours and certain types of clients? Is it that the types of hours be divided a certain way? What is that? The populations that are going to be served and the scope of practice. So, for example, I recently just finished supervising someone for her internship, and her scope of practice had to do with developing so many hours with clients in a number of different age groups, across a number of different techniques. So basically had to document the hours, direct and indirect hours that were spent on these different areas. In the supervision agreement, you also want to include things like the number of hours expected. And now this one I think is very interesting, this next one, how to give and receive feedback. There's a lot of literature, if you look out there, about where supervisees may tend to cut corners. When they're fearful about the evaluative component of supervision, do they share everything they can? Do they document all the risk issues? Do they ask all the questions they need to? Is their assessment as thorough as it needs to be? So sometimes supervisees aren't sure how to bring an issue to a supervisor. So it is very valuable for us to, in the early stages, talk with a supervisee about how they can bring questions and issues to us. Later you'll see that I provide some examples of types of questions or considerations or thoughts that a supervisee might have, things they might want to evaluate even before coming into supervision. Another thing we might want in that initial supervision agreement is a fee arrangement. How much is the supervisee going to be paying for supervision? So it might include language like, this contract serves as verification and a description of the nature of the clinical relationship, the clinical supervision relationship between so-and-so supervisor and so-and-so supervisee. And then specifying the start and end dates for the semester such and such, or for the time period such and such. Then the first area I'd put on there would be called purposes, objectives, and goals. So first of all, we want to include something like monitoring and ensuring the welfare of clients that are seen by the supervisee, promoting development of the supervisee's professional identity and competence, and fulfilling requirements for their school or licensure. Another area you'd want to include in the supervision agreement is the area of what the context of supervision is. So, how often will you meet for supervision? So, for example, in most cases, we're talking about reasonably at least an hour or more of supervision face-to-face weekly. And this is really seen as a guideline. Again, at the earlier stages of development, a supervisor may be doing a lot more didactic teaching, answering questions, role modeling. So there may be supplemental hours, and you might want to write this also in your supervision agreement, that supplemental clock hours may also include a monthly group supervision meeting. Supervision will discuss cases conducted with, and then I'd fill in the blank. So for me, it would be something like cases conducted with children, adults, and families in an outpatient suburban setting. So whatever the population is that person's working with. I put on my supervision agreement that supervision times generally are pre-scheduled, but additional supervision times may be occurring. Excuse me. And I also include how the supervisee can contact me as needed beyond the supervision time. Another dimension I think is very important for us to include in that initial supervision agreement is the dimension of evaluation. How will evaluation be done? I know different supervisors, have different ways they prefer. And like I said, things like supervisee self-report or notes are some of the more common ones. But I would write down what are the methods that are expected. So for example, I might put case notes, video or audio tapes, live supervisions, co-facilitation of sessions, or role plays may be used to evaluate supervisee ongoing performance. Specific feedback of the supervisee will focus on the supervisee's demonstrated counseling skills and clinical documentation, as well as knowledge of and adherence to technical and legal requirements. I think it's important to include that because a lot of times I've seen when I've observed other people's supervision dynamics that there is such a focus on what happens in the therapy session that sometimes I think some of the ethical and legal types of components get shortchanged. So we need to not gloss over and maybe include in that supervision agreement that there is an expectation of looking at documentation, looking at procedures, looking at the ethics of things. And then about how often the evaluations will be gone over. Is it quarterly? Is it every semester? Is it after every so many hours? What I also like about having a supervision agreement is that you have an opportunity to define specifically what are the duties and responsibilities of the supervisor and what are the duties and responsibilities of the supervisee. I think a lot of times with the evaluation component of supervision, supervisees tend to think we focus so much on what they need to do. But if we set it up as there's some expectations of the supervisor, of the agency, of the setting, of the dynamics, then it feels a little more comfortable. So I usually will list first the duties and responsibilities of the supervisor. So examine clients presenting concerns and treatment plans for sessions. Provide ongoing documentation or sign off on the documentation and provide ongoing evaluation. Challenge inappropriate approaches or techniques in session. Intervene if there's risk issues. Ensure ethical guidelines are upheld. Maintain weekly case notes of supervision. And keep a copy of professional disclosure statement on the wall. As well as, you know, facilitating informed consent with the clients and supervisees. Now, I want to go back to one of those I just mentioned. I said maintain weekly case notes of supervision. I think a lot of times this isn't mentioned, but I also think it's important. Just like we are required to have case notes of our interactions with our clients, it is vitally important that there be case notes for supervision. So some of that same language you might use in a good case note regarding a client can also be used regarding supervision. Things like taught such and such technique, discussed pros and cons of using such and such approach versus this other approach, provided education on da-da-da. Empathize with concerns and frustrations about such and such aspect of therapy and provided direction about planned such and such for future sessions. I also encourage supervisees to be keeping their notes about supervision as well. I think this helps both the supervisor and supervisee stay on top of what the expectations are. Now, like I said, the initial supervision agreement should include duties and responsibilities of the supervisor as well as the supervisee. So the supervisee's responsibilities might include things like upholding ethical guidelines, being prepared, including having notes, client files, having associated tasks done, having school and board evaluations ready, and making sure they have the materials for the supervision sessions. One of the things the board highlights is that the filing of training agreements with school or the board needs to be done by the supervisee. So it's important for the supervisee to keep the supervisor posted as to this is what's required. Another thing that's really important in terms of responsibilities for a supervisee is completing case notes. Now, I have seen either past supervisees of mine or even colleagues in different settings I've worked at struggle with completing case notes. This can be a challenge because, you know, keep in mind for most of us, when we went in the field, it wasn't because we wanted to do excellent case notes. For most of us, it was we wanted to hear people's narratives about their presenting concerns and help facilitate healing. So that might be an area that it's useful to write into the initial supervision agreement, because once it's written, it establishes for the supervisee, oh, there is an expectation. As boring as the case notes might be, as much as that's not the most fun part for almost anyone about working in the mental health field, this is something that has to be done. Other duties and responsibilities of the supervisee that you might want to list are things like consulting with the supervisor when things are uncertain, implementing supervisor directives in subsequent sessions, or keeping a copy of the professional disclosure statement of the supervisor on wall. Now, another level of responsibilities that I also have a tendency to put into the supervision initial arrangement is the responsibilities of, well, for me, it would be the practice, since I'm in a private practice setting, but it could be an agency, it could be a hospital, it could be a nonprofit, or whatever the setting is that that person's working in. So I put things like show up on time or early. Some of these sound like common sense, but you might not believe how some of the biggest challenges I've had in the past with supervisees weren't necessarily their work with clients, but things like just showing up on time. Another area, dressing professionally. So modest and professional clothing. So avoiding things that clients might misconstrue, like tight clothing, revealing clothing. Again, one of the things that we have a responsibility to teach our supervisees about is how to consider how our clients perceive things. So I remember having to talk with a past supervisee about clothing. And I'm not saying it's the most comfortable topic, but sometimes it's something, you know, that could turn into an ethics issue if we don't monitor. Because again, the clients are coming in for different issues, and we don't want them to be distracted by things like clothing or other things. Scheduling, you know, so there may be responsibilities of the practice or the agency about scheduling of clients, documentation, what responsibilities about that. Liability insurance. In my setting, especially dealing with insurance companies, each person maintains a minimum of $1 to $3 million of liability insurance coverage. And I write, this is a minimum required by insurance companies. So that's one of the requirements that we talk about. Competency. I also include something about maintaining the requirements of licensure, continuing education, and what that looks like. In addition, I include in the contract things about confidentiality and privacy. So, really highlighting some of those ethical boundaries, like not sharing whether someone has been a client or not, what the treatment plan is, the financial, the scheduling, or any part of therapy without a specific release of consent for that. Then there also is a section in the initial supervision agreement regarding procedural consideration. So how can the supervisor be reached? What if it's outside supervision time? How does that happen? Then there's signatures so that, you know, both people have signed and dated the supervision agreement. Now, in terms of supervisory roles, three roles that you'll routinely see in the literature, regardless of whose developmental or theoretical model it is, are the roles of teacher, counselor, and consultant. So when we're talking about counselor, I don't literally mean a clinician or a supervisor being a clinical counselor for a supervisee. That would be inappropriate. I mean a supervisor offering high levels of Rogers process variables, supportive type of stance. Then the other supervisory role is that of teacher. Again, the didactic approach, filling in the gaps where the supervisee believes that he or she doesn't have knowledge or isn't sure how to apply something. And then finally, consultant, which is a more experienced and a less experienced clinician kind of working as a team. One of the articles used an interesting quote. They said that supervision is, quote, a container for creativity and chaos, which I found is an interesting way of looking at things. So the challenges that supervisees are facing that we really need to keep in mind as they're juggling all this are, one, self-criticism. Remember, there's an evaluation component of the supervisee by the supervisor, by the agency. But that's not it. Within the supervisee, there tends to be a sense of self-criticism too. They're aware that they're under the spotlight. Another challenge is their reaction to clients, is how to remain in the present, in the here and now, when there are certain things clients say or do that press their buttons. Thirdly, a challenge is how to learn and use the helping skills. And then four, how to manage session times. So some of the roles towards that we might do are helping to observe, training, modeling, evaluation, problem solving, or giving feedback. So what do supervisees say that they prefer from a supervisor? So there's different roles they see a supervisor in. One, they see a supervisor as a reflector. They want someone who really listens, hears, cares, someone who they could say, yeah, this person really empathizes with me, and they consider where I'm coming from. So the research supports that those levels of Rogers process variables just really cannot be minimized. The supervisees also prefer a supervisor who is somewhat of a theorist. They are someone who has ideas and concepts of things. They know how to address questions. They initiate discussions that need to be had about things. Third, supervisees see supervisors as activists. They see someone as creating interactive learning experiences. And finally, they see supervisors as pragmatists who have ways of practically applying theoretical knowledge. Now, I said earlier that I would give you some ideas of things that supervisees could think about before a supervision session. And I wanted to provide some of these questions. I think these are useful when there's a supervision relationship to say, hey, here's some ways you might want to approach me. That sometimes it's hard to even know how to put in words what your questions are and what you need. So in terms of supervisee prep for supervision, one of the questions they might want to think about is, what clients am I thinking most about? What feelings, thoughts, or reactions are coming to mind? Am I uncertain in any areas about how to assist with client change? What do I know how to do, but I'm just not sure how to implement? Like, I have theoretical knowledge, but not sure how to apply. Are there any topics I'm unfamiliar with or I'm uncomfortable with? The other thing we can encourage supervisees to do is how to do a thorough evaluation of their cases, even before they come into supervision. So kind of like just a brainstorming. So the things that they should consider are things like, what are the presenting concerns that this client came to the session with? Are there any family of origin consideration? Any cultural factors? And if you've listened to my seminars on multicultural counseling, when I talk about cultural factors, I'm talking about culture much broader than race and ethnicity. I'm talking about culture as the way a group of people does anything. That could be the way they look. It could be where they live, their socioeconomics. It could be the music they listen to. It could be the way they approach a certain issue or their worldview. It could be anything. Other areas a supervisee can consider are the unique personal variables of clients, a client's values and beliefs, the goals a client has for session, thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. If the client's previously been involved in therapy and what that looked like, any collateral information which they can obtain by release of consent. And I can't highlight this one enough, supervisees can look at what is not stated. Sometimes that's as important as what is stated, what is avoided. Now, supervision can be considered either facilitative or didactic. Let me explain the difference between those. And let's talk about when we're trying to have a vision of how to approach supervision, how do we decide if we should be more facilitative or more didactic? So facilitative is what they call more of a reflective practice. It gives both the supervisee and the supervisor a sense of mutual control. It's more focused on the process of the interaction. We're doing this together. We're talking it out. We're dialoguing. We're considering different point of views. So the emphasis is on the interaction between the supervisor and supervisee. So helping the supervisee develop his or her own professional and personal style. So, for example, if it was in a medical setting and you're going to a medical doctor, a facilitative approach would be the doctor saying, "Oh, tell me what you think might be wrong with you. What's your idea on that?" Versus a more of a didactic approach would be controlled by the teacher. It would be looking at the supervisor or the doctor in a medical setting as the expert, as the one in control of the process. It would be content focused and focused on transmitting knowledge. It would emphasize instruction, advice, support, and guidance. So the literature shows that basically our supervisees tend to want guidance, especially in the earlier stages of supervision, where they feel like they're less experienced, but the facilitative approach helps them to have a reduction in anxiety because they feel like they're seen as more of a team. So when we're looking at supervision, we're also looking at areas of responsibility. We're looking at areas where both the supervisor and supervisee have some level of responsibility. In a 2021 article, it highlighted the three main areas of responsibility. So quality of care and welfare of clients, facilitating supervisee competence, professionalism, and professional identity, and third, safeguarding the public and the profession. The competencies are considered either what they call criterion reference competencies or endpoint competencies. So criterion reference competencies focus on specific knowledge areas and training, whereas the endpoint competencies focus on just a general conceptualization of what one knows or doesn't know. So as we wrap up this first section, we just wanted again to look at just some foundational things about what training supervision entails, what some of the responsibilities are, and the developing of an initial supervision agreement. I would encourage you to listen to the audio about the early stages of a supervisee's experience and kind of, you know, see how that impacts you listening to that. When I interviewed someone that I had supervised in the early stages and what that's like for her. And then in the second section, when we return, we're going to get into some of the developmental conceptualizations of how we envision our supervision relationship.